Cambridge 105.
Community radio in your city.
What sparked your passion for cooking?
I have a good appetite and I eat.
I'll often make subtle changes to the next batch of it.
As long as it has room to move around, it's classified as free range.
So my mother gave me a crash course in cookery when I was 16.
I remember sampling this amazing drink, thinking how I've never tasted coffee this good.
Which homemade desserts can be cheaper than shop-bought alternatives?
We want people to feel at home.
It's 12 o'clock on Saturday the 15th of June and you're listening to Flavour with Matt Bentman, Alan Alder and Ruth Reyes.
We have a packed programme for you today featuring a collection of interviews ranging from festivals and fairs to the most recent cafe and restaurant openings from around Cambridge.
You'll be hearing from new Turkish restaurant Merhaba. We drop in on the Bridge Street Beer Festival and learn the difference between East and West Country Cider, courtesy of the Norfolk Cider Company run by a man from Devon. All of this and much more besides.
And for our regular features, wine critic Tom Lewis will be joining us toward the end of the show. This time, the subject is summer wines, and we'll finish with a review of interesting food and drink articles you'll be able to find in today's newspapers. So, let's begin.
In our last episode, Matt spoke with Carol Reynolds of the Reynolds Sweets stall in Cambridge Market Square. Carol and her family have been serving sweets to the people of Cambridge for generations, having been a regular fixture at the market since 1846. Of course, back then the market was situated on Pease Hill, not in the square as we know it today.
In the first part of the interview, Matt and Carol talked about the Reynolds history, the process of making rock, shouting out brandy snaps and nugget at the June fair, and life at the market over the last century. This time we hear about sweet colouring and whether the Reynolds themselves have a taste for sweets outside their working life.
And what about colour in sweets as well? I think we were talking the other day about, was it Bassett's who were leaving out certain colours?
Yes, they tried, and a lot of the manufacturers tried, to reduce the colouring in their sweets. But it wasn't very popular because nobody liked them. They thought they were faded, you know, in the sunshine and things like that.
Just something tried, tested, didn't work. Let's revert back
to... And I think more they've gone into natural colourings more than their artificial colours. So they're better now than they used to be because there are not so many E numbers in them now.
Many more people are aware of that now,
yes,
aren't they?
Yes, people are aware of what they should be eating and what they shouldn't. Because they know what they're doing now. And when they're allergic to things and they asked you if they've got peanuts in them, then that you have to be really careful about how you answer them. So you have to know. And that's where it's nice with my sons. I'm not there so much now. And they've been doing it since they were young men. And they know what they're selling. And they are very careful about it because you get a lot of... It's not just allergies. It's there are some Muslims and ethnic minorities who can't eat some things. So we are very careful about knowing what we sell.
Now, your husband's father, Jack Reynolds, said that he ate sweets compulsively and that it would be as hard for him to give up sweets as it would be for someone to give up smoking. After so many years around confectionery, do you have a similar opinion? Do you always partial to sweets?
Yeah, I remember Jack did eat even after he retired, and he was 90 when he died.
Yeah.
And he still used to love his sweets. Yes, I still eat sweets, and we all do. And I've got good teeth, haven't I? Even people who say, I don't eat sweets, they always do. They always have one.
I did wonder just the fact that you're surrounded by them all the time and maybe just the scent of them would put you off thinking, oh, that's the last thing I want to touch or see now. No?
No, can't smell them. But if we have a new line in, how are you going to tell people what they taste like?
Or well, quite,
if they're nice or not? And I do tell the truth. If I don't like them, I'll tell them I don't like them. But it's up to them if they want them.
Are you partial to any yourself? Do you have any particular favourites?
I like chocolate. We have a old-fashioned fudge, which is really nice. That sort of like melts in your mouth.
You do lots of different types of fudge as well,
we
I
do.
Think, don't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, we do. Loads. And nobody else does, because they're special to us.
Oh, right. The recipes are with you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're special.
Let's mention a few sweet names like barley sugar, fruit drops, pineapple cubes, acid drops, strawberries and cream, fizzy sour dummies, banana fudge. Should we mention some others, ones that are going to have the listeners salivating and reminiscing in equal measure? There must be so many people that have come to you over the years and keep returning to you over
well,
the years
do,
as well.
They do love the nugget, and we do now do a nugget with no nuts in. Mm-hmm. Which pleases people no end, because there's a lot of people who can't have nuts, not just for allergies, but it gets under their plates, you know.
Oh, right, of
and
course.
And things like that, yes, you know. Yeah. The fudges, we've got more of the new ones, because we have a cookie dough now, which the kids love.
Sounds very American.
Cookie dough.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a new flavour, you see. Double chopped chip fudge and the hard sweets. They bring back memories for people, don't they?
Yeah, yeah.
Aniseed twist.
Aniseed twist.
They love aniseed twist, people.
Now, I've not heard of that. I only think of the black and white
humbugs.
Sweets. Humbugs, yes.
Everton mints, they are the black and white.
Are they?
Humbugs are brown. And then you can get some with soft centres, some with hard, all the way through.
Jim used to make some of these, didn't he?
We all did. The humbugs that they talk about for the fair, they were about 2 inches in diameter. That big. They were huge.
That can't be called a bug. That must have some other name.
They were. They were called humbugs, and that's the original shape of them. Before they did the triangular ones, they were huge, big humbugs. And we used to make them specially.
How do you eat something of that size? How do you get through
that? I don't know.
But people did, and they were popular.
And probably held them like a lollipop.
But then you can still buy the big candy red dummies at fairs and things, can't you?
Oh, yeah, we've got dummies.
Yeah.
And the big lollipops.
Yes, yeah. Yeah. And as for the customers coming back, do you have people that, obviously they remember you, but do you recognise them when you see them?
Yes. People are friends now, more than customers.
Mm.
And there are people who come from all over the world to see us. And people that I served when I was young are bringing their grandchildren back now.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it is. A few years back, we had two small children. It was a Saturday afternoon, and they came to see me. And they said, "We've lost our mummy and daddy, but we knew we'd be safe with you. So we've come here, and they'll find us here." And they'd lost them over the Grafton Centre. They found them eventually. They did. They found them eventually. But I sat them on the stool so that everybody could see them, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like a bit like that with our customers. They are, you know, if we're ill or anything like that, people are always very caring.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, it's nice.
Oh, well, thanks very much for this interview, Carol. And long may Reynolds Sweets continue.
Thank you very much, Matt.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
And if that set up your taste buds for some sweets from a bygone age, as well as those riding the current confectionery trends, then you can find the Reynolds Sweets store in the Cambridge Market today, and most every day, in fact, at the corner stall of the Cambridge Market, just adjacent to Don Pasquale's restaurant.
Cambridge 105. We love being local. You bet your FM life.
For those of us who enjoy good and interesting food, East Road is known principally as the home of Cotto, one of Cambridge's very best restaurants. Now a new restaurant has opened, a few doors down, very different in style to Cotto, but of great interest nevertheless. It's Mahaba, a Turkish restaurant owned by Mehmet Atay. He also owns FS in King Street and the Copper Kettle in King's Parade. I went to speak to Mehmet and manager Emin a week or so ago, a few days after the restaurant first opened. Mehmet, you're the owner of Merhaba.
That's right.
Okay, and you're doing food from Turkey? From
Eastern Turkey.
What's on the menu that might be something that people in Cambridge would find particularly of interest and might not have had somewhere else?
Well, for example, lahmacun. Nobody does in Cambridge. And the lahmacun is very well known in Turkey. It's very thin, like a pizza baked, and with minced meat on top of it. And you cook it in the oven, it takes about 10 minutes, and then you serve it freshly with some salad inside, and either you can take it home and eat it, or you can sit down in our restaurant and eat it here.
And it's made of a dough,
yes,
like a pizza is. Is it those great big circles of dough?
That's right, yes.
It's and then it's folded over with the filling inside. Yes, I've had those. I think they're really good. Emin, what else would you mention? There's you've got pides as well. Are they not some sort of pizza type of thing?
They're actually flatbread with different toppings. We have vegetarian pide, or pide with minced lamb, or pide with Turkish sausage and eggs. We do all different toppings.
And are they proving popular, or is it going to take time for people to get used to them, do you think?
No, they're quite popular, I think, although we're quite new, because nobody else does them in Cambridge. We find that people come and try it, yes.
Yeah, I was looking, when I was looking at the menu before, one of the things that I noticed was that there were some, I think, sort of quite familiar things like dolma, the stuffed vine leaves.
Yes.
Which are, I think, a great favourite, aren't they? Well, yeah, that was, yes, that's one of the starters. But when I looked at the desserts, I expected to find something like baklava there, but I was interested that it wasn't there, and I was wondering if there was any particular reason for that.
No, there is no reason, but in every Turkish restaurant in England, not just in Cambridge, they all do baklava. Because we, you know, we have different desserts in Turkey, why not we make others, which is burma and şekare we do here. And our chef, he makes it here, and again, they're beautiful desserts.
I mean, there's something else on the menu that I noticed called, which I hadn't heard of before, called İçli Köfte. Can you tell me about what that is?
They are bulgur wheat croquettes with minced lamb and spices inside. They are actually made by the chef's wife at home. Every day when the chef comes, he brings them with him, because they take long time to make them. They're quite difficult to make them, so his wife makes
them. So is that quite an unusual thing to find in a...
Well, again, you'd find it in Eastern Turkey. In the Turkish
right, but I was thinking in Cambridge.
But not in Cambridge, nobody else does it. No, so we are the only ones who do it.
Right, so this is the place to come to eat some unusual Turkish food.
Oh, well, yes, I think so, yeah.
Real Turkish food, yes.
Yeah. And I noticed in the window the donna, the sort of cylinder of meat that rotates. Where do you get those from?
We make it here. We don't buy it ready. We buy it
right, because most people do buy them ready.
That's
don't
right.
They?
Yes, we buy our meat from local butcher in Cambridge, and then we mince it. Then we put all the spice, onion, pepper. Then we build our, as you said, cylinder dinner. Then we start about 10 o'clock making it, and then by the time 11:30 is ready, it takes about 1.5 hours. Then we start putting it and start cooking it slowly, and when the customer comes, we start serving.
Right, and it's lamb.
It is lamb, pure lamb. Yes.
Right, and what sort of spices are in there? Cumin
and black pepper,
salt and onion.
I think also a distinctive thing about Turkish cuisine is bread, which I think is of really good quality in Turkey. Where are you getting your bread from?
Yeah, we bake our own bread. We bake different sorts of bread here. We don't buy anything ready-made. We cook and bake everything freshly on the premises.
Right. So you must have to start early then, baking bread.
Well, the main chef, he comes in 8 o'clock in the morning. We don't open until 12 lunchtime, so he's got 4 hours with his assistants to get everything ready.
And what are the opening times then? You open at 12 and...
12 o'clock noon until 12 midnight. We're open every day, 7 days of the week.
Yeah. I must say, it's beautifully done out with pictures of Istanbul, are they? I think hand-painted pictures of Istanbul, some pretty nice Turkish sort of tiles as well, and just some nice covers on the seats. Has it taken a long time to get the place sorted out?
We started renovating the place back in January this year, so it took us about 5 months.
Yeah.
And all the decorations you see here, brought them from Turkey himself. He went and buy them and brought them to England.
Yeah, well, it looks really good, and it's nice and light with the sort of the long skylight as well.
Yeah, we had to do that because otherwise there's no windows here, there's no sunlight.
Yeah.
So it's
taken quite a lot of work then. Yeah. Prices?
Well, we have a set menu, which is £19, £95 per person. But with that, we have a selection of cold and hot starters, followed by a mixed grill with served with rice, and then your dessert, and then tea or coffee, Turkish tea or Turkish coffee, and all that for £19.95. I think that we are quite reasonable prices. Yeah.
Set menu gives you a chance to try everything.
Well, three courses for £19.95 is very reasonable.
There's plenty of food there as well.
Yeah,
so.
Great.
And that was Alan speaking with the owner and manager of Merhaba in East Road. Did you eat there, Alan?
I didn't actually, but I will be doing so and I'll report back. But I've just spent a couple of weeks in Turkey and I can honestly say that Turkish food is really good. And the dishes they sell at Merhaba, which is Turkish for hello, by the way, are really worth trying. Pretty reasonably priced too. If you don't know much about Turkish cuisine, they'll be very keen to help. They're very friendly. And you don't have to have a full meal by any means. And there's also actually a takeaway at the front of the restaurant.
Last week marked the return of the annual Town and Country Fair to Parker's Peace. It's a festival of arts and crafts, food and drink, animals, demonstrations, live music, and carnival rides. Matt likes to go there to check out vendors who've come in from a field with unusual, eye-catching wares. First up, on a fresh Sunday morning, was a man from Devon called Steve, armed with a lot of apples, a press, and a lot of history up his sleeve.
That is the sound of trayfuls and trayfuls of apples being put through the mill and remilled. Now, when you go to events like these, you can be sure of some lively and interesting tastes. And here we have the freshest pressed apple juice, which is very smooth and mild, not overly sweet. I'm here today with Steve and his daughter Angelica, who run the Norfolk Cider Company. Steve, can you describe the apple milling and the pressing? I understand you're one of the last people in the East to be putting on a working demo.
That's correct, yes. There aren't many cider makers left in the East now. You've always needed two machines. One, essentially, to crush the apples up. Obviously, the finer you can crush them up, the more juice you'll get out. Mm-hmm. And then you need a press. And this is a typical Norfolk press. So you get about a third of a ton of apples in there. It stands about 8 foot, 9 foot tall. And when the pressure's hard down on there, you've got about 6.5 tons. So the two machines are about 60% efficient. The mill ceased to be manufactured in the 1870s. There was a revival of interest in cider, and you get White Ways and Showerings and Coates and Bulmers and all these companies starting up. That typical press like this is peculiar to the East, Norfolk and Sussex, because we haven't got any stone. The West Country presses don't have a front or a back.
Yes.
And they sit in a hewn out stone trough, so the juice pours out all over the place, but it's caught in the trough, the stone trough, if you like, that the press is sitting in. But we haven't got any stone in Norfolk, so that's why a Norfolk press is basically a box on legs.
Yeah, this is unchanged
for 200 years. This was invented in the 1670s. It's well documented, the mill, by a chap called John Wurlidge from Sussex. He based it on, it wasn't an original idea, he based it on a Cuban sugarcane mill, and he gave it a name. It's called an Ingenio.
It seemed like all times of the day yesterday, you had a veritable throng of people to your stall, and I saw you both you and Angelica, going backwards and forwards, gathering more kegs and bottles every day. It was very busy for you, yes?
We had a good day yesterday. I mean, a lot's down to the temperature, of course. I think the tea and coffee people had an exceptional year last year. Key is a quality product. You know, as with everything, it has to be good, because it's all I drink myself.
And you've been in the cider business for the last 35 years.
I spent several years with Bulmers. I originally come from Devon. Then I moved up to Norfolk to work for Gamers, who used to make the old English cider. Sadly, they no longer exist. And not knowing any other trade, I carried on.
Now, East Country cider, like your Norfolk cider, is made with eating apples, whilst West Country cider uses cider apples. Norfolk cider, I think it says on your website, it lacks the astringency, and so it's far more palatable to a wider audience. More like an apple wine, it's not sharp or severe.
Cider should never be sharp. If it's sharp, if it catches you at the back of the throat, it's past its sell-by date. Essentially, the far older tradition is the West Country cider-making tradition. Probably goes back to the beginnings of agriculture, 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 years ago. They used the only indigenous tree to this country, which was the crab apple tree. And the cider apple trees, the varieties we have today, have basically evolved from those original indigenous trees to the country. It seems to have been a very much a Celtic occupation. If you think about it, we've got the Bretons as a major centre for cider, and also the Basques, who I understand are also Celts. What happened was that when the Romans pulled out, the Anglo-Saxons poured in from the east, and by and large they drank ale, and so they pushed the Celts into the West Country. Mm. And that's why we've got this unbroken tradition of cider making in the West Country still.
Okay.
And again, it wasn't until the Norman invasion of 1066 that the Normans and Bretons reintroduced cider back into Norfolk, Suffolk, Kent and Sussex. But of course, eating apples were more widely available, so that's what was planted. They've got far more uses than eating apple. There is simply nothing you can do with a cider apple except make cider. But the main difference between the two products is that cider apples are exceptionally high in tannin. I have to say why people can get a terrible headache on it.
Yes.
So if it's cider made in the East, obviously there's no preservatives or chemicals, which is the main reason for getting a headache. But then again, there's very little tannin as well.
Mm. Shall we talk briefly about the different ciders and juices that you have here today? I'd like to concentrate on a few. Now, this, on the cider side, you have a sugar-free cider, which you call diabetically dry.
Yes, this is how cider would have been 100 years ago. Essentially, the wild yeasts tolerate alcohol up to about 13.5%. So there's only enough sugar in an eating apple to give you, say, 7 or 8% alcohol. So it will all be converted into alcohol and it'll be a sugar-free product.
Mm.
It's just too dry for a lot of people.
But it is historical and authentic.
Yeah.
And you also do seasonal ciders, of course. You have a winter spiced cider. Would you like us to tell a little bit more about that?
That's a low alcohol, something for Christmas, you know, so if, rather than, you know, buying a bottle as they might do in the summer, if it's cold and they've turned up to a winter show with a low alcohol drink, they can safely have a cup full.
Mm.
We put cinnamon and nutmeg and that sort of thing, but it's low alcohol because it's 50% cider and then the other half is apple juice. So again, it's a pure product.
Both your ciders and your apple juices, they come in sweet, medium and dry varieties. And of course, they're matured for far longer than their commercial counterparts. Your cider tastes particularly closer to wine than cider we were kind of alluding to earlier.
Yes, I think that's simply because it has a fairly high alcohol level, 7.5%, 8%. And as I say, it doesn't have that astringency you get with West Country cider.
Mm. Well, Stephen, thank you for chatting to Flavour. Hope you do have a very good second day here at the Town and Country Fair. If you'd like to try the beverages of the Norfolk Cider Company, you can ring Angelica or Stephen on 07717 116 828. Or you can find them online at norfolkcider.co.uk.
And of course, we'll provide links to the Norfolk Cider Company and the rest of today's features on our podcast page accompanying this episode. You can also keep bang up to date with Cambridge's food news by following Flavour on Twitter at Flavour105. That's where you'll read about the news we discover ourselves, and we also retweet food and drink stories from other Cambridge sources.
Mm. Still to come on today's programme, learn the superfood properties of maple syrup, get stuck in a jam with Saints and Sinners preserves, and we feature some brand new places in Cambridge, Café Cecilia on Regent Street and the Cambridge Vinopolis on Devonshire Road.
In Your Company is Cambridge 105's business programme, presented by me, Sam Davis. In Your Company tries to capture the diversity of the Cambridge business scene by talking to not only the high-tech headline grabbers, but also the sole traders and the startups and the experts who can help us make sense of it all. You can listen to In Your Company at 2 p.m. on Saturday afternoons every fortnight, and podcasts of all our shows are available on the Cambridge 105 website. Community radio in your city, Cambridge 105.
There is a beer festival on at this very moment in three pubs along Bridge Street. Stuart from the Mitre told Alan about the festival's festivities on Thursday.
Stuart, tell us something about the Bridge Street Beer Festival.
Hi, it's the first time that it's been done, and we've decided to get all three pubs along the street involved. So it's the Mitre, the Pickerel and the Baron of Beef. It's in aid of the Arthur Rank Hospice, and we're looking to raise a minimum of about £500. There's over 40 real ales and ciders on offer between now and Sunday.
And do each of the pubs have the same beers or are they different?
No, they're all different. So obviously we're all from different breweries, so we've got some that are affiliated with us, and the same for the Baron, which is Green King, and then the Pickle's obviously different again. We've got a couple of nice new ales that have come on. There's Downton Ed's American Red at 4.8, which is really nice, and there's a new beer by Adnams, which is Fat Sprat at 3.8. Adnams are actually running a Meet the Brewer session at the Mitre on Saturday at 4 p.m. So you can come down.
Somebody from the brewery is coming along. And
yeah, they're going to come down. with some hops and things, so you can have a smell and a taste, and they'll be giving out some free samples as well.
So that's 4 o'clock.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Good. And so the Adnams and the Downtons are at the Mitre. There's some quite interesting ones, actually, aren't there?
Yeah.
Some good names as well. Purity, Mad Goose.
I know.
Okay, so the festival started on Wednesday.
It started today, actually, Thursday. Yeah.
Right, and I suppose it's a bit too early to say what the favourites are.
We've only started this morning. We've got some that I think are probably going to go really well. There's another one by Mordew, which is Al Cherry Pet, which I think is going to be quite popular. It's always difficult to tell at this stage, but we'll see how we go through the weekend.
Yeah, I know we covered the Mitre's Beer Festival last year, or we talked about it before it happened. How did it go? Was it a success?
It went really well, actually. That was for a month. We are going to be doing another one in a month's time, actually, which is just us. But I decided that I wanted to try and get one for all three pubs. Obviously, the students are breaking up this week. So I thought it'd be quite good as all the managers get along the road. So
yeah, great. Well, perhaps we'll come along in a month's time and talk about your festival as well.
Brilliant, thanks very much.
Okay, thanks to you.
And that was Stuart from the Mitre. The Adnams Brewer is at the Mitre today at 4 p.m. and the festival ends tomorrow. As if you didn't already have enough to do, there's currently a beer festival at the Carlton Arms in Arbury. It finishes on Tuesday, but their barbecue is currently underway in the garden.
Yeah, and now Shrove Tuesday may seem a distant memory now, but maple syrup is a versatile fellow. At the Town and Country Fair, Matt caught up with a young couple who are true dyed-in-the-wool maplites, so much so they've made it part of their business. Truly a sticky situation worth getting into.
Now, I do love sweet things, honey, sugar, dried fruits, syrup. So how about some honest-to-goodness, dark, full-bodied grade Canadian maple syrup? That's what we have here today from Mapley Foods and their patrons,
Ian
and
Lindsay.
Welcome to Flavour on Cambridge 105. Now, maple syrup can be something that we take for granted because, yes, we know that there is syrup and there's maple syrup. We know there's a difference in taste between the two and that most of us would choose maple syrup because the taste is, well, preferable. But why is that so? And can you tell us a little bit about how maple syrup is made?
Okay. Every year, around about March to April time, you're looking at a 6-week period where you tap a tree. And you're tapping trees, and each time the colour will change each day and get darker and darker as it goes.
Day by day?
Almost, yeah. So it gets darker and darker, and basically what happens is you're having less sugar and less calories and more vitamins and minerals, so it's increasing in the sort of nutrients and higher antioxidants as well as the time goes on. So what we do is from our family in East Montreal, we bring across the higher nutrient one, the dark one, the darkest one there is, and we actually increase and put value onto it in Lincolnshire. So we're not too far afield either.
And the dark denotes?
The darkness brings a richer, fuller-bodied flavour. So ultimately what it allows you to do is use it on your sweet stuff like people usually tend to do with supermarket-grade syrups. Mm-hmm. But the thing you can go here is one step further. So you can go to a ham, a salmon, and you can put heat to it. And with putting heat to it, it'll actually hold its flavour, which doesn't happen with early grade syrups.
Okay, so hence the term full-bodied grade for your maple syrup.
Absolutely.
Your website goes into detail about this because it explains how there are three grades to maple syrup. That explains also why there's such a variation in cost when you look for maple syrup.
I'll let Lindsay take this one.
Yeah, there certainly is variation in the price. A lot of it's also down to the yield that you get from the tree. You're talking sort of anywhere between 10 and 20% is actually the darker grade as well.
Okay.
So it's actually rarer to get hold of. That's why it's sort of sought after as well.
This may be a slightly odd question, but is there a difference in the thickness of maple syrups as well, or are they all the same?
No, the actual consistency remains the same. It's just the nutrient value and taste.
Speaking of the nutrient value, I read there's an American doctor who recently completed a 2-year study on Canadian maple syrup. It's his flavour profile findings suggested that it's something of a superfood, in fact. Being rich in minerals, like you said, in manganese and riboflavin, and having less sugar than normal syrup and honey. And it being distinct, as in the flavour's not merely sweet, but it's rather umami?
Umami, yeah.
This is a term that distinguishes another element of a superfood. It means savoury and wholesome.
Yes, it certainly does. Yeah, it gives that whole flavour that you get from maple.
And that ultimately leads on to the fact about this lower sugar, this umami, be it allowing people like type 2 diabetics to add it into their diet. You wouldn't use an early grade syrup into a type 2 diabetic's diet because it's higher in sugar, but if you come to something like this, a darker syrup, you end up with a GI number or glycemic index number of 51 as opposed to 55. And you don't, if you're looking at dietary content of a type 2 diabetic, you don't give anything that's 55 or over.
Now, on a slightly different note, you also do, I understand, maple whiskey and maple tea.
Yeah, we certainly do. We're very proud of our maple whiskey in particular. Yeah. That's something we actually put together in our factory in Lincolnshire. Our maple whiskey is Scotch whiskey that we blend with our maple syrup, and it goes down very, very nicely indeed.
Now, you just mentioned at the beginning of the interview what creative things you do with maple syrup on food. Your leaflet, it already mentions that it can be used with pork, chicken and roasted veg, for example. Would you like to expand on that a little bit?
Obviously, with the maple syrup itself, you can do, it's such a versatile product that you can do it on pancakes and porridge and whatnot, but that's the beauty about the product, that the actual grade that we import is the fact that you can cook with it. So you can, with bakery things like flapjacks, cheesecakes, anything with a really an oaty base or oats to it, soaking them in that maple syrup is absolutely divine. And then obviously you've got your meats that you can marinate. I even use it as part of a salad dressing sometimes as well, just to
add
a bit different to your salad, yeah.
So you got into maple syrup through, you have family links with Canada,
I understand.
I must stress that not everybody with Canadian links sets up a maple business in the UK. So what was it that made you go that extra mile?
Being truthful about it, it was when we were out there, when we tried the actual syrup itself and tried that particular grade, we just thought, you know, we can't get hold of anything like it here. So we just said, why don't we look at setting something up?
And what's happening is people are actually using this in their porridge and in like tea and coffee, because the bad news and the bad press that the sweeteners have given have only helped us really in terms of putting people more towards depression or something to that effect, and these really, because with its low sugar content, are really helping.
How has the weekend been for you so far?
We've had a great turnout, fantastic feedback, certainly a lot of people making purchases and enjoying our product, which is just great to see.
This is your first time doing this?
It's the first time in Cambridge, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's really nice.
Well, thanks very much. Have a great day.
Thank you. Take care. Thank you.
To find out more about Mapley Foods, that was a little Canada jibe I slipped in there. Their maple syrup, their Montreal whiskey, or the maple tea bags, which is perfect as either a hot drink or served as iced tea, then you can check out this family-run business online at mapleyfoods.com. I'll spell that. That's MAPLEY. And yes, it was the best maple syrup I've ever tasted by a long way, and I do appreciate good maple syrup.
Me too. Well, cafe life in Cambridge continues to get richer. Yesterday on Regent Street, Cafe Cecilia opened, and Alan went along and spoke with Anthony Kay about it.
Anthony, you've just opened for the very first time.
Yes.
Tell me about the cafe. What sort of foods are you selling?
Well, being a traditional Sicilian cafe, we're trying to replicate a traditional bar from Sicily. So we're going to be selling a selection of sweet pastry items, including cannolo siciliano and various other mignons and tartlets. We are also selling a selection of tavola calda, which is hot fresh food, including traditional Sicilian arancini and a selection of pizzas. We also, our coffee brand is Sicilian, called Michele Adoro.
How did you choose that? Because there's quite a lot of different coffees to choose from.
Well, yeah, absolutely. We tried and tested several different brands and came to the conclusion that Michele Adoro is far superior to any other brand in quality. And so far, the feedback we've received has been fantastic.
And how would you describe the flavour of that coffee?
It's a medium roast coffee, and the aftertaste of chocolate and caramel, just fantastic. It keeps people coming back for more so far. So.
Well, that's good to know.
Absolutely.
And the foods, where are you getting the foods from?
We're working with a selection of local suppliers, including traditional Italian pastry chefs, traditional Italian chefs, who are all local, and we are preparing paninis and ciabattas on premises ourselves.
Yeah, so
with fresh ingredients.
Right, so it's all pretty fresh then.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And what are your links with Sicily?
My mother is Sicilian. Her parents moved over here in the 50s, and my mum was born and raised here. A lot of our Sicilian family also moved over around the time in the 50s, so I've got a large Sicilian family base here as well as in Sicily.
Right. And are any of them working here? Because most of your staff seem to be...
Yes,
I don't know
yeah.
whether Sicilian or Italian.
Absolutely,
I'm not adept at telling the difference,
the
to be
difference.
Honest.
Sometimes neither am I. The large majority of staff, fantastically, are Sicilian. There are a certain number of family members that are also working with us, but
yeah.
we decided it was extremely important to try and keep it as authentic as possible, hence why we've got Sicilian members of staff.
Yeah. Have you got an alcohol licence, or will you be applying for
we
one?
We will be applying for one, so watch this space.
Yeah, okay.
Because again, that's, you know, something traditionally in Italian and Sicilian bars, you will find liquors for sale. So we're going to be looking at doing that very soon.
Yes, not always a quick process, I think.
Sadly not.
How many are you open? What hours?
Daily, Monday to Sunday, 7:30 a.m. until 7:30 p.m.
Great. And you can sit outside, I know.
We've got outdoor seating, and it's a perfect little sun trap in the afternoon. It's brilliant out there. So, yeah, people can, you know, enjoy sitting inside, or they can sit outside and soak up the lovely Regent Street atmosphere.
Well, it is interesting sitting outside watching the world go
Absolutely,
by.
Absolutely, yeah.
But if it rains...
Yeah, we are having an awning fitted, which is going to be down every day, so weather won't be an issue.
Right, so as long as it's warm.
Yeah, they just need to bring a jacket because it could get a bit chilly.
Right, great. Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
And that was Anthony Kay from Cafe Sicilia in Regent Street, which is no relation, by the way, to Aromi in Bennett Street.
And what did you think of it?
Well, obviously, I didn't really even begin to sample what they had because they've got a wide range of foods, as Anthony indicated, and it all looked very enticing. The coffee was very good, though, I thought. The cafe's on one floor, and there seems to be a good amount of space, and there's the seating outside too, so you should be able to have quite a relaxed time there exploring Sicilian food. Worth a try.
Now, if you're a fan of jams, toppings and spreads, you'll like this next piece. Put aside your humble marmalade, do away with that tasteless conserve, and it's time to observe and reserve a preserve with a collection of jams that will make your toast blush.
I'm talking to Saints and Sinners Preserves. Hailing from sunny Lincolnshire, Saints and Sinners make jams, marmalades, chutneys, mustards and more. Now, the driving force behind the company are husband and wife team Elaine and Andy, who are, in their own words, describe one another as the oily rag and the mechanic.
I'm definitely the mechanic.
Elaine, you took preserving from a hobby to a full-time business around 5 years ago. But what was it that kicked off this whole preserving idea?
Well, I've always preserved right from being very, very young. We had a plum tree in the garden, and that's what we started making, was yellow plum jam. And then I've done it all my life. And then about 5 years ago, it just, as you say, took off into a business that's taken over the house as well as our lives, I think. So it's an absolute passion, and I think if you've got a passion for something, then you follow it through right to its optimum amount.
Did you do lots of other styles of cooking before you got the preserving bug?
Yeah, I started off training as a chef originally years ago, gave that up and went elsewhere. But then I think if you like food, if you're a true foodie and you have a true passion for it, you can't help but experiment, you can't help but try and do things that are slightly different.
Now, all of your products, they're properly homemade, and you source some of them from a nearby organic farm. This has the double effect of, say, reducing transport costs and minimising wastage, yes?
Yes, it does. It's a great setup that we've got with the Woodlands Organic. What we do is we have all their seconds. We never know what we're going to get until Thursday morning when we open the shed. So it challenges me in making 144 pounds of bananas, is one example.
What did you do with them?
Banana walnut and vanilla jam, banana and butterscotch jam, banana chutney, and quite a few other things. But what it does is it takes a product that you would normally discard or look at and think, no, I really can't do anything with that. And then you make it into a beautiful product that loads of people enjoy and gives the product another life, which is fantastic. And you can do it in your own kitchen. Just look in your fridge and see what you've got in the fridge and churn it into something.
And this is a lovely setup you've got here on your store. How many jars have you got here roughly? 200 to 300?
About 300. We do 200 different varieties, and there's about 300 jars here at the moment.
Each one of them almost seemingly have a unique little cover on the top of the jam jar.
Very proud of my product. Need to make it look pretty, and it gives a point of difference as well.
Yeah, you're very meticulous, aren't you?
Oh, incessantly so.
And since you've been making these, you've been gaining recognition for the quality of your products. For example, your Lincolnshire Scrumpy Marmalade received a commendation in the Delamain Marmalade Awards of 2012. See, this is why I haven't competed on the marmalade circuit for the last 5 years, because you've got it all sewn up.
Absolutely. It's a very prestigious marmalade event that's run throughout the world. It's international. But what I did with mine was I used a local scrumpy cider maker. We cook it in the oranges in cider for 3 hours. So it takes away the alcohol, but leaves this amazing intense flavour.
Now, Elaine, where does the Saints and Sinners name come from? Is this an apt umbrella term for your jams and chutneys? Because you do have a lot of combinations that seem to have a big kick to them.
Yeah, it started actually as cakes and preserves, which was the very naughty cakes, which was the sinners. The preserves were better, but it quickly proved that the preserves were the way to go. And now, you're correct, we have very naughty things like cherry and chocolate jam, down to Seville orange and honey marmalade, which obviously has got reduced sugar in it, so a lot better for you. So yes.
I must just quickly ask, Elaine, what's the difference between a preserving pan and a normal saucepan? Because on your website you've published some recipes, and being a lover of chutney, I was taken by your spiced plum chutney recipe, and everything was going fine until it mentioned the preserving pan.
Preserving pan has a very thick bottom because you need to be able to put a lot of heat into there that's a constant temperature, and if you get a very thin bottomed pan, it will burn. Okay. Whereas the thicker bottom pans, they have a longer heating time, so you've got more of a constant temperature right the way across the bottom of the pan. But if you wanted to make that, you could make it in a slow cooker, which has got the same effect.
Okay, I do have one of those. Yeah. Good.
In that case, I'll look forward to tasting it next year.
Now, as well as finding Saints and Sinners preserves at local events, listeners, you can also order these products online. I just thought this was important to point out because your products are almost exclusively sold in the Lincolnshire area. But everything here that we see can be ordered online, including gift packs, I believe.
Yep, gift packs are very, very popular because of the fact that they look so cute and country made. They are fantastic for Christmas, they're fantastic for birthdays. You choose what goes into the gift packs.
Oh, good, yeah.
So you're not forced to have something that you know that your aunt or uncle or whatever wouldn't like.
And your website details, your contact details?
It's www.saintsandsinnerspreserves.co.uk, and our phone number is 01775 724 580. I would say, though, don't always answer the phone when I'm making because of safety reasons, so leave a message.
Okay. And don't worry, listeners, because Elaine and Andy will be back on Parker's Peace on September the 15th and 16th for the Food and Garden Produce Festival. So that's in 3 months' time, and that gives me exactly the time I need to make your spiced plum chutney recipe. As it says, once I've made it, I need to leave it to mature before eating, so I can tell you how it went the next time I see you.
Absolutely, and I expect a taster.
I'll bring some along.
Fantastic.
And what's been going off the shelf here this weekend?
At the moment, lemon and pineapple marmalade. We've got apricot, almond and amaretto marmalade, and our mustards, which are quite infamous because they're tree mustards.
Did you say apricot, almond
and amaretto?
What a lovely combination.
It tastes like marzipan. It's absolutely fantastic.
Oh, jam. That sounds great. Well, thanks very much,
no
Elaine.
Problem at all. Pleasure. Take care.
Thank you.
Once again, you can find direct links to our featured interviews on the Flavour podcast page accompanying this programme. And if you have any questions for us or something you think we should cover, please get in touch by emailing us at flavour@cambridge105.fm, or you can tweet us at flavour105.
And not only is there a new Sicilian cafe open, but there's also a new wine merchant, though this one is one with a difference. The difference is that you can take a container along or use one provided by the shop and have it filled with one of several white, red or rosé wines direct from the cask. It's called Cambridge Vinopolis and is in Devonshire Road, off Mill Road, and next to the Devonshire Arms. Ella went to find out about it from owner Nick Hall.
Nick, you're selling wines on tap here at Cambridge Vinopolis, and that's something that's never really taken off. I remember buying some in the 80s on tap, but it's never really got going. So what are the advantages of it, and what's attracted you?
Well, the advantage of my wine on tap is the fact is that inside the actual barrels is a refrigeration. So you've actually got wine on tap that actually comes out, the white wines and the rosé, that are much cooler temperature, whereas before, they're just ordinary red wines coming out room temperature. If you're going to the park or you want to, I do half bottles. Obviously, the idea is that you can come in and bring your own vessel, like a jerry can, for example, like some people do,
right.
and fill up. That's entirely up to yourself. But I have my own bottles here in the shop as well.
Yeah. And what about the quality? Can you get, have you got access to good quality wine in this way?
The quality of the wines are what I call their everyday drinking wines. So you're looking at wines, they're from a single estate just outside Bezier, so they're not bucket wines, they are decent wines, and very, very drinkable. Right. I mean, the proof's in the pudding. I mean, my customers come into the shop, they taste the wine, and before they buy it. The problem is, in England, is that I find when you get offers in supermarkets, is that you've got a label, you don't know exactly what's behind the label, and here you can experiment, you can try all the wines, and obviously if you don't like them, then you don't have to purchase them. I'll give you a little taster, so you can try the white wines or the red wines or the Muscat, and if it pleases you, then obviously you can purchase a bottle of wine.
Right, and what are the prices like?
The prices start at £6.95 for a bottle, which is 0.75. If you want a litre, it works out better value because it goes to literally £7.95 a litre. That, of course, also you bring in your own container. The whole point what I'm trying to do is that a lot of customers already are recycling. So half the, maybe 60 to 70% of the bottles that I've sold have come back to me I've sterilised them and they're back on the shelf. So it's everything's been recycled. Even the kegs that I have here are, again, as you can see in the corner of the shop, they're ready to be picked up, a new wine set. So everything here is quite green.
Yeah. But you also have some bottles on the shelves, so you're not just selling from kegs.
No, I have some of my favourite wines. I'm passionate about the Languedoc, having lived there for over 2 years in the Languedoc.
And what do you like about those wines? Predominantly the red wines, presumably.
I like them because the problem is with Languedoc, it's had a reputation in the last, say, maybe 20 years ago, and the wines have improved so much. Being a Bordeaux wine broker, for me, they're tasting, I'm not saying as good as maybe the top wines in Bordeaux, but they're punching way above their weight for wines that I've got on the shelves for £10 to £15.
So because of they had a reputation in the past, the prices are still lower than
prices
for equivalent quality elsewhere.
You're getting value for money. I've only been open just over 6 weeks, but what I'm finding is all the wines, for example, all these Languedoc wines here, I'm selling them fastly. For example, these three wines here, the Pechmanel, Note d'Offie, and Le Croix, basically I'm selling roughly around about 20 bottles a week already in my store because I'm so confident how good they are for the price. They're constantly coming back and repeating and buying one or two bottles. Which
right, and I can see the prices of those vary between, £9 and £10.50.
Absolutely, and some are going up to sort of up to £15. For example, this guy here was an amazing story. He worked for Lynch Barge, bought a big Bordeaux house, and then he came back to where he was born in Languedoc and set up. And this is equivalent to, say, what I think is a £40-£50 bottle of Bordeaux, and it's only just under £15.
So that's the La Maggiora for those who want to experiment with that.
Absolutely.
High-range wines, you've got many more expensive wines?
I've got some wines from Burgundy, which is Grand Cru, for example, Marcenais, which is quite famous. Then I have some good Clarets, good Bordeaux, and a couple of really nice wines from Côte de Rhône.
How do you choose them? Because there's a heck of a lot on the market, aren't there?
Thousands and thousands. It gets very confusing. I stick to, if you see, I've got a format. I only do European wines and mainly cork. I don't have any red wines with screw top. I don't do any New World wines. So I mainly just do literally European wines from Italy, Spain, Portugal and France. And they're generally all single estates. So I like to support small vineyards.
There's a Vinopolis in London as well. Is there any relationship between your shop and that company?
No, not at all. Vinopolis originated in Belgium. They're friends of mine. They've been around since 1935. Obviously, when I was doing this, when I had this idea of having wine on tap, basically I went over to Belgium to make sure I could use their name. And obviously, having formed a relationship years before being in the business, there was no problem that I could use. So that's how I became Cambridge Vinopolis. As in London Vinopolis, it is actually a complete different system, because that's actually just a wine city and the wine inside it is actually a complete different company.
Right, so no relation?
No, none at all.
And what are your opening hours, Nick?
My opening hours are 11:30 to 8 o'clock, that's Monday to Thursday, and Friday and Saturday I'm open 11:30 till 9 o'clock.
Okay, and Sunday you're closed?
Sundays are debatable at the moment, so I'm going, because I'm quite new, I'm sort of experimenting, but Sundays, if I am, it's 12 to 6.
Yeah, okay, thanks very much.
You're welcome. Tom.
And that was Nick Hall from Cambridge Vinopolis in Devonshire Road. I bought a bottle of Syrah from the cask, and as Nick said, it was light and very quaffable, ideal for summer drinking. And that's what Tom Lewis is talking about today, isn't it, Tom?
That's right, we're talking about wines for summer. I thought we'd shake things up a little bit this month. And instead of recommending specific wines, what I thought I'd do is suggest some areas where you can get to know your local merchants and the sort of things that they specialise in.
Right, so if people have been listening to this programme for the year or so that we've been doing it, they might be interested in that, I think, being a bit more adventurous.
Well, I'd like to hope so.
Right. So what's your first suggestion?
Well, it's something we've talked about before in depth. It's sherry. Sherry is a great summer drink. It's fresh, it's perfect on its own, or with food on a hot summer's day.
Are we talking about Fino sherry?
Yes. I mean, Fino's the basic style. It's pale-coloured, it's crisp, and it's refreshing. And it's got a yeasty flavour from the floor. That's the yeast that grows on top. There's also Manzanilla, which is a Fino with a more yeasty flavour. That comes from Sanlúcar.
Right, and what about food matches?
Well, for this, think about tapas, cheese, salami, bread with olive oil, anchovies. It's a perfect picnic wine.
And where would you go to buy that?
Well, all of the local merchants have sherry, but here the experts are Cambridge wine merchants. They've won awards for their range, so go and ask them about it. And I'd start with Hidalgo or Tio Pepe. They're the obvious starting places.
Okay, next?
The next thing is beer. I mean, what else would you drink on a summer's day? Just don't go for cheap fizzy rocket fuel. Try a craft ale. The best place to go for this is Bacchanalia. They have real ales from all over the world, all types, all shades, all colours. And if you go to the Mill Road branch, you can even buy your own beer straight from the cask. They have 2-pint hoppers or 4-pint reusable jugs.
Yeah, now the last pop-up at Fitzbillies, which I don't think you were there, Tom. I certainly didn't see you. I had a single hot beer, a Citra, in fact, from the Netherlands, which you can get from Bacchanalia. Though actually, I think I bought the last bottle last Friday, but perhaps they've got more in now. But it really is excellent, and I think quite a lot of people there would be interested to know you can get it at Bacchanalia.
Absolutely.
Anyway, let's move on.
Well, the next one is, again, something we've talked about before. It's Austrian wines. As I said when we talked about them, they're really crisp and they're fresh. They're perfect summer wines.
Yeah, that was quite recent, but all the same, can you remind us of what to look for?
Well, Austria's signature grape is Grüneveltliner. The wines are mostly full-bodied, they've got lots of refreshing acidity, and they match well with food.
And what sort of flavours?
Well, Grüner means green, and the flavours are quite green. Think of things like pui lentils, celery, white pepper. They're the sort of traditional descriptions that we use. But when you have a Grüner, what really is going to dominate on the palate is this fresh linear acidity. It goes all the way through the development of the wine on your palate. The other interesting fact I can tell you is that it's very responsive to its soil type. So the mineral character in the wine, that perception of wet stones, is much more pronounced if it's grown on rock, and especially granitic rock, more than mixed soils. So if you really want to impress a local wine merchant, go in, ask for a Grüner, and ask about the soil type and how that's reflected in the wine.
Right, well, there's a thing to do to amuse yourself. What about food matches?
Well, Grüner's very versatile. In some ways, it's a bit like sherry. It's more about body and freshness than overt fruit flavours. So it's a really good palate cleanser. The kind of foods it works well with are what I describe as sort of white and well-flavoured. So think of pasta with cream and mushrooms, plain roast white meat, meaty fish, or pale hard cheeses.
Right, and where to go for that?
Well, our local expert on those is Noel Young. He's won awards for his range, so I'd pop down to Trumpington and chat to him.
Anything to look out for especially?
Well, my favourites are Smaragds from the Wachau. Now, the Wachau Valley is the region, that's just up the road from Vienna, and Smaragd is the ripeness level. So these are the biggest, the ripest and the fullest wines.
Right. Okay, and finally?
Final thing to look at is biodynamic wines.
Now, is that the same as organic?
It takes organic as a starting point, but it goes a whole lot further. So organic basically means no artificial fertilisers, pesticides. These are things that can only be good for you. And the trick for the winemaker here is to keep the grapes healthy by natural means alone. What biodynamic does then is to add in some distinctly pagan, almost druidic overtones. We're back to the 70s prog rock analogies that we talked about before. The sort of things are like burying a cow horn full of dung in the earth, or picking the grapes according to the phases of the moon or the alignment of the stars.
Does that really have any effect?
Well, who knows? I mean, I've had some really good biodynamic wines. Whether it's due to that cow horn full of dung or something else, I really don't know.
What about the so-called natural wines? Where do they fit into this?
Well, natural wines take this even further. They're the sort of bearded sandal wearers of the wine world. Again, they start with organic practices, but absolutely no additives allowed at all. So this is a bit like eating raw fish or unpasteurised cheese. Everything's got to be absolutely scrupulously clean and hygienic for it to work. Now, again, natural wines can be absolutely incredible. I've had some really vibrant and textured ones. Unfortunately, they can also be utterly awful. They can be spoiled and faulty because you can't add any sulphur to preserve them.
Yeah, but this is where you really need a wine merchant to have done his homework, isn't it?
I think so, absolutely. For me, biodynamics, it does allow for some small amounts of sulphur needed for preservation. So whilst natural wines are quite controversial and a little bit risky, I don't think that's true of biodynamic or organic.
And where can you go for these?
Your man for biodynamics is Charles Hardcastle, who runs Joseph Barnes Wines in Saffron Walden. Most of his wines are sourced from Languedoc. It's a really exciting area. And as it's summer, you could go for a white, but there are also rosés and very light summery reds, probably all of them from grapes that you've never heard of. But as we said at the beginning, the idea here is to be a bit more adventurous after all.
Yeah.
Good. Thanks, Tom. And remember, too, the new Cambridge Vinopolis has some Languedoc wines you could try. But whatever, I hope you feel inspired to go and try something new and maybe tell us about any new finds or things you've tried for our next programme. We're Cambridge at
105.fm.
How can I forget that? Thank you, Matt.
Missed one of your favourite shows? Well, don't despair. Head over to Cambridge105.fm, where you can download a selection of show podcasts, featuring regular podcasts from our business programme In Your Company, film reviews from Bums on Seats, everything that's tasty and refreshing with our food and drink show, Flavour, plus replays of guest interviews from 105 Breakfast and 105 Drive. There's something on offer for everyone. Get downloading now at Cambridge105.fm.
And now over to Alan for the newspaper review.
Right, OK. Actually, before I do this, Matt, just a quick mention that there are still a few tickets left for tonight's Cambridge Food and Wine Society's chauffeured punt and barbecue outing. You can find out about it by going to their website. The details are on there. But basically, the arrangements are you meet at the Granter pub in Newnham Road at 5:15 for a pre-punt drink. It's £34 for non-members and £30 for members. I should think the barbecue will be pretty good.
Yes.
Right, anyway, after that, a rather squeezed newspaper view today. So we'll just look at the food and drink ideas in today's Guardian and Financial Times.
Okay.
Hugh Fenning Whittingstall has some unusual, simple and wonderful-looking recipes for strawberries, including savoury recipes. Fiona Beckett talks about red summer wines, including how to identify one before deciding whether you should buy them or not. Yotam Ottolenghi's first recipe is a beautiful-looking buttermilk and bay leaf tart. In the Guardian's Cook magazine, there's features such as giving recipes for raw dishes. Dan Leopard provides three recipes for a gluten-free afternoon tea. There's a reader's recipe spread covering barbecued food. And for those of us who have at last tracked down a source of the Middle Eastern spice sumach, these include sumach chicken skewers.
Mm. And what's the source?
It's Al-Amin on Mill Road.
Oh, very good.
Yep. As could be predicted, I think.
Yes.
Now, I've started to grow horseradish, so I'm pleased to see there's a feature in Cook on what goes well with it. In the Financial Times, Rowley Lee has a recipe for quails with chickpeas, pimento and almonds. His preamble talks about the book of Catalan cookery the recipe comes from. Meanwhile, Tim Hayward's page is about cookery books and the evolution in our favourites, how we've evolved from Elizabeth David to Delia Smith, the River Cafe cookbook, Morrow, and now there's a new colossus.
Ottolenghi, perhaps?
Yes, indeed. And Ottolenghi lovers will be pleased to know he's currently filming some more programmes about Mediterranean food.
I guess, are we due a feature on cookbooks soon at all?
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about that, and I'm hopefully going to have a review from Clara Paul from Books for Cooks in Notting Hill on the next programme.
Lovely.
Jancis Robinson's article is about the wines of the Jura region, which is southeast of Burgundy. Apparently, they're the height of fashion in New York and typically sell here from between £12 to £20 a bottle. Hugh Fernie Whittingstall recommends trying strawberries in salads with avocado, fennel, cucumber or red onion, and he says they go well with basil, mint and black pepper. Really, he's got lots about strawberries, which will help you sort of to mix them with all sorts of interesting things. Anyway, there's some good stuff in today's paper, but I really can't finish without mentioning there's also a feature on food from Bolivia. And listeners will be fascinated to know that both Hugh and Matt failed to identify a photograph of what caldo de cardan is, and it's actually bull's penis soup.
There you go. How do we miss that? Well,
I think it's probably a good thing you couldn't recognise it, actually.
Well, thank you, Alan. That brings us to the end of another show. And many thanks to all of our contributors. Carol Reynolds of Reynolds Sweets, Mahmut Ateo of the Turkish restaurant Maraba, the Norfolk Cider Company, Stuart from the Mitre Pub on Bridge Street, Mapley Foods, Anthony Kay from Cafe Sicilia, Elaine from the Saints and Sinners Preserves Company, Nick Hall from the Cambridge Vinopolis on Devonshire Road, and of course, wine critic Tom Lewis.
And don't forget to follow on Twitter at Flavour105, and that's where you'll read about the news we discover ourselves and also retweet food and drink stories from other Cambridge sources. And the next live edition
Open will be on Saturday, June 29th at midday. And you can find our previous episodes on our podcast page on the Cambridge 105 website.
So do join us next time. And coming up next is Saturday Lunch.
Goodbye. Bye.